I always like to say the bottleneck's at the top of the bottle. And so if you're having problems on a team, look to the leader first. You know, is the leader really doing what they need to do? Are they spending time coaching and mentoring, or are they just being a manager? And those are different skill sets, but they're equally important.
Welcome to the High Performance Legal Entrepreneur Series. My name is Adam Arkfeld, an entrepreneur, marketer, and seeker of high-performing habits, tips, and strategies. Each week, I'll bring to you an elite performer, a legal expert, or simply a strategy to help you see and follow the path to personal greatness in your firm and life. Thank you for joining us today. Now let's get started. Welcome everyone to the High Performance Legal Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Arkfeld, president and founder of Prevail Legal Marketing. And today, Michael Erath is joining us. He is the founder of Next Level Growth, which is a firm of business guides that helps companies like yours operate and scale. Michael, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the invitation.
So let's start by just hearing a little bit about how you got into the coaching business. I know you owned a business before that, but I want to hear a little bit about your background with coaching.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. So make a long story as short as I can. I grew up in a family manufacturing business back on the East Coast. We were in the hardwood veneer business. We supplied furniture companies, kitchen cabinet, door, and panel companies. We manufactured the hardwood veneer from the raw material, from the logs themselves. And so in my early 20s, I took over the manufacturing side of that business in Virginia. My wife and I were in Roanoke, Virginia for about 15 years. And as part of the growing and scaling of that business, I wanted to vertically integrate. So I brought on a partner after I had taken over the business. We formed a separate entity within the overall parent company that focused on timber trading. So what happened was in the veneer business, we typically only utilize for our raw material the highest quality logs that would come out of the forest. And it was very competitive. So we decided by vertically integrating, we could go in and actually buy standing timber. We could buy large parcels of timber at a cheap price. And then we could glean off internally the veneer logs, and we would merchandise everything else. So with that vertical integration, we ended up scaling from $8 million to $45 million in revenue. We were at 200 employees at our peak. My business partner and I became best friends. I was his son's godfather. We vacationed frequently together with our wives. In 2009, as the housing market was starting to collapse and revenues were declining, my CFO discovered that my business partner in that entity had not only embezzled over $500,000 in 18 months, but was committing bank fraud. So I obviously got a very fast and deep legal education in a number of areas. Going through that whole process, my partner ended up, after about 4 years, pleading guilty to 2 felony counts and served 2 years in federal prison. I ended up working with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the lender through that time period to take the business through an orderly liquidation as a result of everything that had happened, rather than let it go into bankruptcy and fighting it out in court. I had my mother hung on a guarantee. I had bought her out. My father had passed. So I had a lot of odd things going on at that time that I was trying to protect and manage. So through that process, I was able to get the bank made whole. I got the creditors made whole and took the haircut myself. But I got through that with my credit intact and with the equity in our house remaining. So I was able to then move. We moved to Ohio, where there was a contract manufacturer in our industry. Started a new business that I capitalized myself, got a small line of credit, and basically kept a few key employees and started over from scratch. As I was building that business, I had transitioned from YPO into EO, and I came across the book Traction by Gina Wickman, which describes the entrepreneurial operating system, or EOS. And over my career, I had used bits and pieces of different systems, things I had studied, top grading, Rockefeller Habits, E-Myth, The Great Game of Business, and I done some bits and pieces implementation of some of the tools, but in EOS and Traction, I found for the first time somebody had not necessarily created new content, but assimilated much of what was out there in the entrepreneurial space and distilled it down to something that was simple and digestible. So I started implementing that in our business. We began growing rapidly. We made the Inc. 5000. And I was also bringing in some tools from other systems to fill in some of the gaps that I had found in EOS. And through that process, a few of my colleagues in EO back in Ohio were also trying to implement EOS in their business, but they were struggling with it and asked me to come in and just kind of freelance, start helping them. And I did. And the more I got into that, you know, coaching and working as a guide with them to help implement some of these tools and systems, I was realizing that not only was that something I enjoyed much more than being tied to this manufacturing business, but I also had a unique set of experiences having gone through everything I did in my prior business and going through all the struggles that I did, which helped me better work with them and provide some value that most coaches would not be able to. So in 2015, I decided to exit the manufacturing business and start doing this full time. So it's been about 6.5 years now that I've been working full time as a business guy.
Now, you've been doing EOS. You did EOS for a number of years, but you somewhat recently transitioned out of at least exclusively using that system. Or can you explain what happened with your, not what happened, but what that transition looked like with your business?
Sure, absolutely. So when I started working with as an EOS implementer, we as implementers were under a license agreement to use their trademark terms and their content. And under the license agreement, while EOS as a system and philosophically, they very much focus on what they refer to as purity, meaning that EOS is a one-size-fits-all system. They will say things internally like it's everything that any organization needs. You should never need to go outside of the EOS tools. And I simply found that to not be true. There are areas where EOS is fantastic. It's very good at functional accountability, at execution, things like that. It's not very strong in strategy. It's not very strong in finance and some areas like that. So I was bringing in other tools from other systems, even as I worked as an EOS implementer. And while they didn't like that, under the license agreement, there was nothing they could really do to stop me from doing that. And it was providing more value for the companies I worked with. And that was my intention. And that's who really I was there to serve. EOS sold to a private equity firm about 4 years ago. And in doing so, the private equity firm started to kind of lock down the way they treated their implementers and how they expected us to act and behave. And there were some questions or concerns as to whether they were crossing lines in employment law because we were all independent contractors. And I think to that end, they decided late last year to transition to a franchise model. And so in doing so, the franchise agreement, the contract behind that has some restrictions in it, which simply I could not accept in terms of restrictions around what we could and could not do. Claims that they would own all of our clients' data, which I could not accept. So for those reasons, I decided it was time to part ways. We kind of mutually decided that was best. And I started Next Level Growth, brought in some additional coaches. And we're focused much more now on, rather than bringing a system to our clients and trying to fit them into a system, we make that journey more about the client. And our role is to learn and master tools and concepts from multiple systems and multiple thought leaders, and then bring to our clients what they need when they need it to help them build more of a customized operating system that's tailored for them, rather than trying to force them into a one-size-fits-all system.
Well, you know, anyone that's familiar with EOS or scaling up or any of these systems, I think it's just good to know that, you know, how it works behind the scenes, because I've known about these for a long time and I wasn't aware that there were certain restrictions kind of placed on implementers, especially in EOS. You know, I hear people talking about EOS implementers all the time. And, you know, it sounds like it might not be in the best interest of companies, the restrictions they're putting on the implementers. But will you just sort of explain how implementing one of these systems works for a business if someone's never gone through the process? Like, you know, how are you meeting with them? What are the types of things you're talking about? You know, before I had heard of it, it's like, you know, if you've never had chocolate ice cream, you don't know what it tastes like. It's like, you just right. don't have any concept of what it is. And you're not a coach per se, an individual coach for a single entrepreneur. You're helping create systems for a business. So can you just talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So, So currently I'm working with 31 different companies, and the way that we work with them is I work with the leadership team, kind of the executive or C-suite team. I run their quarterly offsites and their annual planning summits. So we typically meet 5 times over the course of a year, or 5 days rather, 4 times. So we do a kind of a 1 day quarterly, 2 day annual retreats. And we start with what I call base camp. So when we start working with a new company, we have some foundational tools and structures that we help them implement. So functional accountability charts, strategic vision and planning documents, helping them really understand what the overall purpose is behind the firm, and doing that in a way that they can articulate it well, not only externally from marketing perspectives, which is where most professionals focus, but also internally, how they can message that purpose internally to their team members, to their staff and employees. And so we really focus on 4 key areas. We're part of a broader organization that's called Pinnacle Business Guides. And there is a founding principle behind the Pinnacle Group. And that is that if you will obsess and focus on these 4 areas, which are really getting great people into your organization, which are people that align with your values, their behaviors are aligned with your values, they're high performers in the roles that they play within the organization, and they're emotionally engaged with the purpose behind the organization. You offer them and you lead them by an inspiring purpose. You have optimized playbooks, the processes of how you operate as a business to create consistency and scalability, and a culture of performance. If you'll really obsess and focus on those 4 things, that will lead to best in class cash flow and profits, which is really the fuel for the business, right? That's not the point of business, but it's the fuel, the oxygen that's needed for business. And so if you have a very purpose-driven organization, a very purpose-driven firm, the more you can generate cash flow and profits and growing those, the more fuel you have to achieve that greater purpose as an organization. So we come in our base camp, and we help get the foundational tools in place to begin that journey. And then once the foundation is in place, our focus is, we like to use a mountain climbing analogy, with the ultimate goals of the firm being to summit the business mountain that you're climbing, what you're ultimately trying to achieve as a firm. And so our role is to then help guide you and your team up the mountain based on the circumstances you're facing, based on the goals that you have and what the overall objectives are.
Now, what advice would you give someone who runs a firm? Mm-hmm. Let's say their family is a family of attorneys, you know, they went to law school and they're running a firm of 3, 4, 5 attorneys or whatever the case may be, but it's not really purpose-driven per se. You know, people get into businesses and run businesses all the time that don't have strong purpose. An identified set, stated purpose, you know, maybe there's other purposes behind the scenes. What advice would you give someone that's in that scenario when you're saying, you know, purpose is one of the 4 core components of what you do?
So we leverage lots of outside resources, especially some reading and some other thought leaders to kind of help spur along those thoughts. But at every business owner's core, there is almost always some reason beyond making money that they started the business or started the firm. And so really helping them spend time trying to understand and tap into that. There are really 2 resources that we like to use. The first is a new book by Simon Sinek called The Infinite Game. One of the things he talks about in The Infinite Game is this idea of a just cause. It's the 2nd chapter of the book. And I think really clarifying what the just cause is that your firm, your organization is advancing in the world. There are a couple of components of a just cause. What makes it a just cause? One of them being it has to be in service to others. It has to be about serving someone else, but it also needs to be something that is very aspirational and something that you in your lifetime are not likely to achieve, so that it becomes more of a movement that you're advancing. A great example of that, I've got a client that I work with that focuses on adolescent and young adult behavioral health, especially for young adults and adolescents who've experienced life-altering trauma. And as we focus on their just cause, they focus very much on the teen suicide rate as a key metric. And so their just cause is to eliminate teen suicide, right? That's something they'll never fully accomplish. But what they start focusing on now on a shorter term basis is reversing the trends in teenage suicide rates. And as kind of a BHAG, their 10-year target is to contribute to getting us to a point in the United States where teen suicide rates are at the lowest level in recorded history. So what that does, by having an inspiring purpose like that, the therapist and the counselors and the people that go to work for that organization, if they can articulate that very well and get people emotionally engaged in that purpose, those people, one, in this kind of great resignation we're going through, those people tend to stick with the organization longer because they're connected to a purpose. They tend to get more joy out of their work because they can connect the dots as to why the things I'm doing on a day-to-day basis really matter in the bigger picture. Excuse me. And in doing that, they tend to bring greater effort to the work that they do. They'll go further for the organization than employees who are not engaged with that purpose will. And all of those things, if everyone in the organization is rallying around that, helps us build better organizations and do more good as we grow.
Do you have any examples of purpose-driven organizations and companies that are, you know, not very sexy, where you would think there's no way this company can have a strong purpose, but it's like behind the scenes or something else? You know, I kind of think of like, I don't know, manufacturing, I guess maybe because you brought up manufacturing. It's like, how do you make that purpose-driven?
So I think a good example might be, there's a trades company that I work with. It's HVAC, plumbing, and electrical. Not very sexy at all. Many of their employees maybe finished high school. They've gone through trade school and they've learned the trades. Their just cause is to restore dignity to the trades in America. Right? If you think about what you see in high schools today, there's this mindset that everybody should go to college. Everybody has to go to college. And I just don't think that's true. There are many people getting out of college who have consumed significant amounts of wealth. They've taken on significant amounts of debt. They're not working in the industry that they got their education in. And the world needs people in trades. We need that here in the States. And for people who are of that mindset and that's what they want, these people can come out of high school, go through trade school, and be making very good salaries with no debt, you know, in their early 20s. And have a significant head start in life on people who, you know, are spending a lot of time and money on college to get a degree that they're not likely to even use. So that was one example of kind of a not sexy business, but they've gotten very clear on that. And part of their messaging is they go back and get very nostalgic and talk about kind of the founding of this country, and the building of this country was done on the trades. Right? And it was really tradesmen who built this country 100 years ago. And so restoring some of that integrity to that and dignity to that is in their purpose.
Yeah, that's a great example. I mean, I've never heard a purpose like that. And I don't even really know how to explain how it's different. Like, I don't know the words to put to it, but it's just a different, you're always thinking about like, different types of impact you're having on people, but I really like that. I mean, that's a great example. Thanks for sharing that.
Sure.
You also mentioned high performance culture or
culture of performance.
Culture of performance. Now, what comes to mind for me is there are some roles in my business which are fairly easy to measure. You know, there's KPIs associated with them that are obvious, right? Like, you know, we do advertising. How many ad accounts are you advertising? You know, whatever. How much revenue are you bringing in? But there are a lot of roles that are not that way. And so can you talk a little bit about roles that are maybe more amorphous, or I don't want to say vague, but where, you know, How do you bring KPIs into every role? And I'm just assuming that's what you mean by that. If that's not what you mean, you know.
That's a part of it. Yes. So we teach scoreboards and scorecards. So scoreboards comes from four disciplines of execution. The idea being, and they also talk about it in Great Game of Business, that we want to have visual scoreboards where employees in the organization know the score, they know how they're being measured, they know how they're performing, if they're winning or losing at any point in time, you know, while they're playing the game. When I think about some of the roles like you've talked about, I think any role, no matter how easy it is or how difficult it may feel to be able to get to measurables for everyone in the organization, if you start by thinking about every role in your organization, every seat on your org chart has a mission. So take a law firm, for example. There's a mission for a paralegal. There is a mission for someone in admin. Each of those seats has a consistent outcome that you want them to deliver, which is what you're investing in having them in that seat for. And so being able to clearly articulate that is very important. And so the way we teach functional accountability charts is that every seat in the organization, if you think about, you know, most people are familiar with what an org chart looks like. If you were to take that and really build it out based on functions in the business, not on titles and people's names, build out that structure. And for each of the seats, clarify what the mission is. So for example, someone who's a head of marketing in a firm, for example, they may have a mission of consistently growing the number of target market leads being delivered to the firm. It's a simple stated mission, but that ultimately is what you're investing in, for example, in that seat. Once you know what the mission is, you can then get to a KPI for that seat by asking the question, if the individual who's sitting in that seat thought they were doing a great job and were asked to prove it, what would they most likely measure and report to you in order to prove success in achieving that mission? That will almost always get you to one, two, or three appropriate numbers that you can use to measure their performance in the role. What I like to do is encourage my clients, when you're going through that process, do it in dialogue with the people in the seat. So for example, if I were an attorney and I was sitting down with a paralegal doing this, I would ask the paralegal, so what do you think your mission is in this firm? And we would actually have that conversation. So if that was your role, Adam, we'd be having that conversation. And I typically know in advance where I think it needs to land, but I want to see if you know, right? And so I'm going to use that as an opportunity to guide and coach you to kind of land where I want it to land. But you now feel engaged in that. And so if you feel like you participated in memorializing your mission, you're much more likely to focus on it. And then if we talk about, okay, so how would you measure success if that's the mission? And you help me come up with your metrics. Again, you're going to be more accountable to those because you were part of the process to come up with them versus if I just come in and say, here are your numbers, this is what you've got to hit. You may or may not understand it. You may or may not agree. So doing it in a way like that, you're actually building a relationship. You're building trust with the person that's in your charge. And you're also getting buy-in from them because they're part of the conversation. They're part of developing those numbers that they're going to ultimately be held accountable to achieve.
Yeah. And this is, I'm taking more notes on this podcast than I've taken before for myself, not for like follow-up questions.
Fantastic.
So, I mean, you know, I'm just kind of thinking about my own company. Mm-hmm. Can two roles share the same metric, KPI?
Yes.
You know, like one thing that we've always talked about, and there's always been a bit of a challenge for my business, is retention. And so Sort of the conversation has been, who is ultimately accountable for the retention of a client? Should it be our strategist or an account coordinator or someone else? And I'm just curious to hear what your thoughts on something like that would be.
Sure. So I do see that often, kind of where one specific measurable will be tracked cross functionality. or across certain teams or verticals. And what I always focus back in on in a case like that. So tell me again, you said strategist and account manager. Were those the two roles?
Basically, okay.
So the way I would look at that is the purpose of the measurable is to validate performance in the role. And also if it's off track, to kind of send up a flare to say, hey, we need to look here because something's not working. And so let's say there's an expectation or a goal for client retention and you're missing that goal. At first pass, that's not going to tell you if it's an account management issue or a strategist issue. But if those are the two seats that are accountable for that, then whomever the leaders are that they report to, get in a room with those individuals and start looking at the specific examples. So what I would typically do is say, okay, let's take the last 5 clients we lost or the last 10 or whatever the appropriate number is. And let's just put a list up on the whiteboard and let's go through one by one. What happened? Why did we lose them? And I'm looking for the commonalities among them. And are the majority of them leaving because of strategy issues or something around strategy? In that case, that's where the problem lies. If it's inconsistency within our account management, it was a lack of follow through, they got frustrated or whatever that may be, then I'm looking more to the account management side. But that's going to allow the leader to start better understanding the direction that they need to go to really kind of peel the onion and get down to the underlying root cause. And one of the things I always tell the companies I work with that I'm very evangelical about is that I honestly believe 99% of the issues that we face in organizations, the fires we have to fight, if you really dig down to the underlying root cause, it's either a people issue or a process issue. And the reason that we tend to avoid addressing those is that dealing with process and improving process is cumbersome work. And it takes a lot of time, and we often say we're too busy. And so we allow the process to continue to be broken or non-existent. We continue to go back to having the same problems over and over again because we're not dealing with the process. If we have good processes in place and we've got our playbooks and that's all dialed in and should prevent those issues from happening, then we almost always have a people issue. And that could be a lack of training. It could be as simple as somebody made a mistake. It could be that somebody's not really engaged, doesn't care, they're not following the process, whatever the case may be. Or maybe we've elevated somebody into a role where they really don't understand what they should be doing. We've kind of Peter principled them out, and that's the problem. But I think if we always try to dig down to the people and process first and look there, you're much more likely to get to the underlying root cause of the issue that way than if you are kind of chasing symptoms.
The way that you just described that, one of the ways I've thought about this is I think about people in process a lot. I tend to always go to the process first. If there's a problem, I tend to go look at the process first. And then if there's a solid process, then I look at the person. And I've talked about this with other entrepreneurs. And I think a lot of people tend to go to the person first because that's the one that's doing the behavior and is the one doing the work, right? So like they're the problem. What would your recommendation be on that? Is it process first, people first, some mix?
So the way I tend to look at that is my first question is, well, do we have a process that should have prevented that from happening? Right. I'll just start there. And if the answer is no, then we need to go deal with process. What's funny is oftentimes the answer is, yeah, we do. I'm not sure where it is. Well, that's a problem, right? And that's one of the problems with process in general is that for companies that do the work, most of the time they do the work and it gets put on a shelf somewhere or filed away somewhere deep in the server and nobody knows where the hell it is. People aren't looking at it. One of the things that I like to teach, and this goes back to the performance side, is if you think about outside of the corporate world, every professional, be it an athlete, an actor, actress, performer, they all have practice schedules, right? So there's time when the team is on the field and there's time when they're practicing. But in our world, in the business world, every day that your employees show up to work, they're on the field. But when do we ever practice? And usually we don't. And that's why a lot of these processes fall to the wayside. So what typically happens is, and I'll speaking to a law firm example, new paralegal comes on board. If they're lucky, they go through an onboarding and training process. But in all honesty, most employees don't get onboarded, they get waterboarded, right? They show up and it's like, okay, here's your desk, here's your email account, here things are. We throw them off in the deep end and hope to God they don't cause us a lot of problems and we go back to our business. So beyond that initial training, if they're fortunate enough to get that, when do we ever go back and retrain and go back to the basics? If, you know, we're here in Phoenix, if you were to go to watch the Arizona Cardinals practice, you're going to see these, you know, grown men who've been playing football since Pop Warner that are still running blocking and tackling drills every day in practice. The most basic things they could be doing, but they're doing it to keep those skills sharp and to continue. You know, they go back to these plays and they've memorized the playbooks, but they're running the plays over and over and over again in practice so that on the field, it's natural. But what happens in our business is we come in and after that initial training, let's say it's a larger firm and there are multiple paralegals, if they're not constantly sharpening the saw and going back to retraining around process, it's human nature. They're each going to kind of build their own shortcuts, their own workarounds, but they're not going to do it the same way. So if that's allowed to happen, months and years down the road, you may have all of them doing things a little bit different, and that creates absolute chaos within the organization and prevents it from scaling and growing. And so somebody has to really be the champion of going back to the basics and, you know, whether it's quarterly or some sort of a frequency to have some practice and retraining going on within the organization.
Yeah, I love this conversation because we have pretty solid training. I'm a process-oriented guy for sure. And we'll bring someone in, we'll train them, and we'll train them on things that they have no idea what's happening, right? They barely know how the organization works, like our processes. And then we'll train them once or, I don't know, a month or something. And they'll start getting accounts and they'll start getting the workflow. And then something will happen where they need the training, but like they had no context before. And so they kind of fumble the task that needs to be done. And we're like, well, we taught you how to do that, but right, it's just not working. And so we end up, if they stick it out long enough, then it's fine. Like eventually they kind of pick it up, mm-hmm. but some people get frustrated and, you know, then we look at them as underperforming when really they probably have all the skills. They just weren't trained enough or consistently enough.
Yeah. I always like to say the bottleneck's at the top of the bottle. And so if you're having problems on a team, look to the leader first. Is the leader really doing what they need to do? Are they spending time coaching and mentoring, or are they just being a manager? And those are different skill sets, but they're equally important.
Now, you walk into a lot of professional services firms or just businesses in general. You don't know. I mean, you've probably seen hundreds, thousands, I mean, tons of businesses, right? What are the things that you see most commonly in organizations that, I don't want to say broken because that's too negative. It's just, you know, where they're to be fixed easily or the most obvious issues that arise? Is it people? Is it process? I mean, what are the issues you typically see that are holding back a company the most?
You know, I think one of the most common things I see, and this is really industry agnostic, is that, and it honestly goes back to probably one of the first books that was ever written about systemizing a business, which was Michael Gerber's book, E-Myth, is that most business leaders are so deep in the weeds of their own business that nobody's really looking out over the horizon. Nobody's looking at the business from the outside in and being, taking that view or that lens. And when we're as leaders too deep in our own businesses, it makes it very difficult to see what's really going on. Which is one of the interesting things for me getting to be an outsider. I always, when we go off site, when we have one of our quarterly or annual sessions, I always encourage people to literally shut off their electronics for the entire day, and really try to get their mindsets in a place of looking at their business as though they're watching a reality TV show and they're not characters on the show. What would they be saying? What would they be yelling at the TV when they see the behaviors and things that are going on, and just trying to get that mindset shift, I think is very important. And that's, I think, one of the biggest areas where people get stuck is they feel like they have to be really deep in the business, and deep in the weeds. And by doing that, they create a lot of confusion. leaders will get too deep into other areas of the business where people can't then have room to elevate and grow. So that's one of the biggest things is I think just really being able to take a big step back from the business and spend time working on it, not in it.
Al, you keep using the word leader. And from my experience in EO, that's a challenging word for people to kind of identify with. People are always questioning their leadership. What would you say, what advice would you give to someone who maybe doesn't look at themselves as a leader, even though they're running a firm, or just doesn't have that belief about themselves, or doesn't label themselves that way?
So I think that anyone who has direct reports at any level within the organization needs to be taught and encouraged in being a leader. If you have people in your charge, you're a leader, right? And part of being a leader is mentoring and coaching. And so what I do with companies that have direct or individuals that have direct reports, I really focus on a handful of areas that because they have direct reports, they have to obsess about. And it ends up on this functional accountability chart. I write out the phrase lead, manage, retain, and hold my team accountable. So if you have direct reports, number one, you have to obsess about leading them, which that's the coaching, the mentoring, the building a relationship, the encouragement. You have to manage them, which is occasionally the discipline. It's kind of holding them accountable to numbers, things like that. You also have to retain your teams. If you think about retention of employees, whether it's a firm or any type of organization, most people go to work for the company, but when they leave, they quit their boss. They don't quit the company, they quit the person that they work for. And if you think back over experiences, you'll likely see that to be very true. And so retention is on the leader of the individuals on the team, which means you have to focus on the relationship. You have to treat them as more than just an employee who shows up to earn a paycheck and produce work. You need to get to know them a little bit and be willing to be vulnerable and share some life stories with them so they can connect with you and you can connect with them. That creates better retention. And then lastly, you have to be able to hold them accountable. One of the biggest challenges I see with people in any sort of leadership position at any level within an organization is a reluctance to hold people accountable and have the hard conversations when they need to. Either people avoid them altogether because they don't like the confrontation or they don't want to come off as not being nice, or they do it in a way that's just really rude and toxic and not necessary. I think Alan Mulally, there's a book about Alan Mulally, who was the CEO of Boeing that went to Ford when Ford was losing $70+ billion a year and turned him around, called American Icon. And he has some style about him. There's a thing he refers to as joyful accountability, which is a really nice way of holding people accountable. So for example, in a firm, if you've got a growing firm and you've got processes on how things are supposed to work and flow within the firm, and one of the attorneys is not following that, that's going to create all kinds of problems downstream administratively and whatnot. The way Alan Mulally approaches things like that is, let's say you were that attorney, Adam, is to say, Adam, if you don't want to follow our processes, it's okay. If you don't want to do that, it's just not okay for you to do it here at this firm. So if you're not going to do that, you may be making a conscious decision to leave the firm, and that's okay. Love you anyway. But I need you to understand that may be your choice and you're making it. So what I just did in that, and what Alan would teach, is that all I'm doing is setting the expectation. The choice is entirely yours. And so I'm setting the context that, Adam, you're making a choice to either be part of this firm or not, but we're not going to tolerate you not following our playbooks, not doing things the way that the rest of us are to try to create a more consistent, scalable business.
Yeah. And like with everything you're saying, I'm just thinking about my team and all the things that we could be doing better. Sure. And I feel like we have a pretty good team, but I'm like, this is such great advice. Great. Well, I want to ask just one last question, sure. Before we start to wrap up here. And when I'm talking to clients, I like to say, if it were my business, this is how I would run marketing. Mm-hmm. And so, if you kind of put yourself in that mindset a little bit, if you owned a law firm, let's say 3-4 attorneys, you know, what would be, and I know that's hard because, you know, you don't know what the problems are or whatever, but what are some of the things that, what are some of the steps that you would take? You took over a firm to stabilize and grow the firm. What's that process look like for you with having so much experience seeing different types of companies?
So I want to back up and share one thing that I've seen, especially in law firms, and I see it a lot in CPA firms as well. And it often becomes one of the biggest challenges to them being able to actually embrace and implement kind of a business operating system in the organization. And that is that most, and I'm not an expert in law or law firms, I've just had the opportunity to work with some, but it seems to me that most of them are designed around this model where each of the attorneys essentially share some expenses, they share some overheads, but they each really have to eat what they kill. And it's a handful of solo practitioners who happen to be under one specific brand or shingle. So they have different marketing and biz dev plans. They have different ways of doing things, different ways of interacting with their staff. And so that lack of consistency can create some problems or breakdowns. And so I think for law firms to really be able to scale, they have to adopt at a high level, kind of at an executive or partner level, they have to adopt more of an entrepreneurial mindset, and they have to look at the firm through the lens of any business. And I think if you really simplify and dumb down how businesses work, it doesn't matter your industry, it doesn't matter what type of business you are. If you imagine a funnel laying on its side, every business has some sort of a marketing or business development function that exists to extract target market leads from the population and the markets they serve and get those leads into the funnel. The mouth of the funnel is kind of conversion. And so that, you know, maybe you call it sales, in a traditional sense, that'd be considered sales, but that's about taking those target market leads and converting them into clients. Once they become clients, you have an operations function, which is how we fulfill our services, you know, make our products and get them to market. And the output of that is cash, right? And so it's the finance function. And so if you think about these functions, whether it's business development, operations, sales, or finance rather, whether marketing, sales are separate, thinking about your business that way, and then adopting the mindset that in this law firm, we need to have single point accountability for each of those major functions. So who among the firm is the right person to be accountable for the marketing or business development? And so when it comes to then our business development plans, whether we're partners or juniors, the individual who's accountable for that marketing function is helping us establish best practices for how we develop business. We have to be willing to be accountable to that individual to follow our marketing plans and to hit our numbers and those things. What I often see break down in a law firm is kind of ego getting in the way and individuals saying, yeah, I'm not going to be accountable to them, right? I'll do my own business development. Same thing, you know, operationally. Somebody has to be accountable for how the processes flow within the organization, what those expectations are. And everyone else has to be willing to follow those playbooks, to follow those processes, and be accountable to the individual who we've said is kind of the champion of that or who's accountable for it. So you have to have a little bit of a mindset shift to set that ego aside. And so if I were charged with running a law firm, one of the first things I would do is I would get really clear on how I message that. And I would start to set that context with everyone in the firm that in terms of how we operate, we're going to operate more as a business than a group of solo practitioners. And that's going to require a little bit of a different mindset. I would be very, very outspoken about that in the interview process as I'm thinking about bringing on new attorneys and growing that way. Because what I'd want to do is filter out the ones who aren't willing to or not able to look at the firm that way. And that are going to stay stuck in that, you know, I'm a solo practitioner. I'm going to eat what I kill. Trying to get a little bit away from that mindset, because when the group of attorneys start to come together and function under that type of a system, it allows the business to scale much faster than if it's just going to grow by adding more attorneys.
Yeah. And I would imagine if you're going into a firm with that mindset and, you know, sort of taking it over, there's a good chance you would lose some attorneys or some staff Absolutely. That are not into that structure. And then, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm saying, but what you have to be willing to accept, and I always tell people when we start working together, if you're really going to embrace this and get value from it, it will cause turnover. But what you'll find looking back on it is that it's always the right turnover. Right? There may be some collateral damage that gets scooped up in that process, but almost always everyone that left the organization in hindsight needed to go. They needed to move on. And if we get better about knowing who the avatar is to bring in and what makes them right, it just makes us that much stronger going forward.
Yeah. And then the other piece of that is the hiring, what you were saying about being really adamant about that message. You know, I've sometimes thought if I push my message too hard, it might push someone away. But that's sort of the point, right?
So, you know, it's funny you say that. So whenever I am interviewing somebody, whether we're expanding our coaching network or bringing on more coaches, or it's, you know, someone to come in administratively, and I even do this with clients or prospects, rather, I put as much energy into trying to unsell them as I do on trying to convert them. Because what I find is, one, when you do that, it actually makes you more attractive to people who are going to be a right fit. And it also, I think, is high integrity to be, this is who we are. And if this is not going to feel right to you, we shouldn't be wasting each other's time. Right. But it also establishes you have a very clear vision for who you are and who you want the firm to be or the organization to be, and that you're not going to deviate from that. And for the right people, that's a really attractive place to go.
Yeah. All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much. I took a ton of notes on this call. Why don't you tell people, the listeners, where they can find you if they're interested in you know, learning more about you and your services?
Yeah, absolutely. So our website is nextlevelgrowth.com. You can connect with us there. You can learn more about our coaches. We've also got a business health checkup. It's about 37 questions that focus on these four different areas, from people to purpose to process and playbooks and to performance, as well as cash flow and profit. You can take that checkup. It does not put you into an email drip campaign, so don't worry about that. You will get an email back with your results, and it breaks it down in each of those categories to just help you get a feel for, you know, where you're strong, where you have opportunities. And you can reach out to us through that, through the website, or at the email address startclimbing@nextlevelgrowth.com.
Great. Well, thank you again. And everybody else, thanks for listening. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Okay. Thanks, Adam.